Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine. Your Health, providing practical health-related news and information for our community, as Dr. Page and Goldstein specialize in patient care at UNC Family Medicine. And now, Your Health.
Welcome to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health, supported by UNC Healthcare. I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein, and I'd like to welcome a guest co-host today, Dr. Warren Perry. Welcome, Warren.
Thank you. Glad to be on.
Well, you know, it's great to have you on as a new emergency room physician at the University of North Carolina with a passion about public health and communication. That's great. But first, before we get started, we are going to have a great show today. We're going to be talking with author Mary Otto about her recent book, Teeth, The Story of Beauty, Inequality, and the Struggle for Oral Health in America, something I'm actually interested in. My whole family were dentists. I was the black sheep of the family, went into medicine, but I'm looking forward to this conversation.
Likewise.
Let's start out with some of the research that matters. And our very first one actually is about oral food challenges performed in a doctor's office. What are oral food challenges? That's not just like eating, right?
No. Well, it kind of is. Basically, you're in a control setting with a physician who's obviously licensed and trained, but they basically see what foods that you might be allergic to.
This is interesting because we know that so many people have allergies and things like shellfish. I bet you've seen some shellfish allergy in the emergency room. What other food allergies do you see?
You see peanuts. You see certain fruits like strawberries, pineapples, pretty much anything.
I saw a patient the other day who came in, a young adolescent, and it appeared that he had maybe had a walnut, part of a science experiment in school. And it's interesting. You would think he'd been eating nuts all his life, but he may not have ever actually had a walnut. And apparently that's what, you know, had a bad allergic reaction. In this particular study, they're talking about, well, people who have these food allergies, can some sort of testing in the doctor's office be done to see, do they really have this allergy or not? And I think they reviewed 600 food challenge tests done in allergy practices in five different cities and found only 2% produced a severe allergic reaction, and 13 to 33% had some type of allergic reaction. They go on to say that this perhaps means that it may be safer than thought to do this testing. What do you think?
I mean, I agree. If you're in a control setting and you're in a place where you can have rescue medications such as epinephrine, albuterol, and medications that can reverse anaphylactic reaction, I think it's safe because you always want to know, you know, when you're going out to restaurants, what foods you might be allergic to.
Yeah, I think part of this is being in a place that really has the facilities to do this safely, because 2% of a severe allergic reaction, that's 120 people here. Yeah. And even though they're suggesting that some of this could be done in primary care practices, and I think there are practices that are perhaps set up for this, you have to be prepared for a severe allergic reaction.
Definitely.
All you really need is 1%, I think, or more to say, boy, this could really go south quickly. This was published in the Annals of Allergy, Asthma, and Immunology. I think it's an important study, and I do think if you had food allergies, getting this food allergy testing done to see was it really real and what can be done about it, that's a good thing.
I agree.
Maybe talk with an allergist.
Yes.
Great. Let's talk about our very next research that matters, and it's about smartphones. And I'm not so certain I follow this whole line of thinking. I'm hoping you're going to help me out. I'm just a country family doctor here. But it was about, is the use of smartphones somehow related to falling condom sales? And reduce of smartphones to falling condom sales. Where did I go wrong on this one?
You know what's funny? I saw this on CNN a couple weeks back, actually, and it appears that they're saying that because kids are less in contact, physically in contact with their peers, that they're having less sex, basically, which is causing condom sales to fall. That's pretty much what it's talking about.
Is that a bad thing?
Well, I guess depending on what you look at, is it a bad thing or a good thing?
If you were the sellers of condoms,
exactly,
it's
probably
a bad thing.
I think they're more getting on the fact that smartphones are making us less engaged with humans and human beings and like in the physical setting, like meeting up with people. I don't necessarily agree with the fact that it's smartphones. I think it's just technology and medicine overall has made condoms less, not necessary, but less appealing to the younger population. There's like, for example, for pregnancy, there's IUDs, there's OCPs.
Oral contraceptive pills.
Exactly. Yeah. That women would prefer using over condoms.
Yeah, I think that point is probably really legitimate. And I think that we should not ever forget that, unfortunately, things like IUDs or oral contraceptive pills can protect against pregnancy, but they're not going to protect women against sexually transmitted diseases.
Exactly.
And that condoms, usually even two forms of birth control, are really recommended both for pregnancy and prevention against sexually transmitted diseases. But I would be real careful because I think if we blame the smartphones, we're going to be having a number of smartphone producers, Samsung and Apple, be coming after us. And I think we got enough problems right now.
Yeah, yeah.
Last research that matters has to do with just an article that I think was in the New York Times. It was about alcohol abuse in older adults and a rising rate. I found this shocking, but maybe not so shocking because I've seen it in many of my patients that I just hadn't really thought about asking them about alcohol consumption because maybe everything looks okay. And then one time I ask about alcohol consumption, I find out, you know, they drink 5 drinks a night. Okay, this is an important issue.
Adam, I think I ask this question 20 times a day in my practice. This is important issues. I mean, I was not surprised by this article. There are some people that come into the emergency department who I'm telling me how much alcohol they drink in a day, and I'm just like flabbergasted. But, you know, it makes sense. I think the article spoke about reasons why this could be the case. They talk about how the younger population are post-prohibition, so they don't have that, you know, bad taste in the mouth about the alcohol is bad. Then there's also the recent recession we unfortunately went through that might have heightened the rate of alcohol consumption. So a lot of reasons why it could be high.
Yeah, and this was published in the Journal of the American Medical Association Psychiatry Subspecialty Journal. This is a major issue. It's one that I think we need as providers to be asking of all of our patients, not making assumptions about who may be drinking, who's not drinking, and counseling them that excessive alcohol use causes liver failure, liver damage, something that we could prevent.
Yeah.
Well, that'll conclude the Research That Matters portion of our show. We're going to take a short break, and when we return, we'll be talking with health journalist and author Mary Otto about a recent book, Teeth, The Story of Beauty, Inequality, and the Struggle for Oral Health in America. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Warren Perry. We'll be right back. UNC Family Medicine's number 2 ranked national program is rapidly transforming healthcare through excellence in teaching, clinical care, and research. To participate in UNC Family Medicine's efforts to move innovative ideas into action, call 919-843-5112 or email yourhealth@unc.edu.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Warren Perry. Today on Conversations, Warren, we're talking with health journalist and author Mary Otto about her recent book, Teeth, The Story of Beauty, Inequality, and the Struggle for Oral Health in America. Welcome, Ms. Otto.
Really glad to be with you.
You know, it's really interesting and we're really fascinated. There's so many different things I'm fascinated about this topic about oral health that you're talking about from such a large perspective. But I guess we'd like to know a little bit more about you. First off, how did you get interested in oral health and writing something that could transform the oral health of hundreds of millions of people?
Well, it started out with one story of one patient. Actually, I was working as a staff writer for the Washington Post in 2007, and I found myself at the hospital bedside of a young boy, a Maryland boy named Diamante Driver. He was 12 years old, and it turned out he was dying of complications from, tooth decay. He had an abscess tooth, and he was in Children's Hospital. By that time, he'd had 2 brain surgeries and a number of weeks of hospital care because this bacteria from this abscess tooth had spread to his brain, doctors told his mother. And ultimately, all that care, 6 weeks of hospital care costing about $250,000, didn't save him. He died. Mm-hmm. And I wrote about his death for the Washington Post, and it turned out Diamante was among the majority of Medicaid children who were not then and are still not getting routine dental attention. And the Medicaid children are just a part of the American population that isn't getting routine dental care. Roughly a third of us here in America don't get routine dental visits because of problems with poverty and shortage of providers in some communities, a lack of dental benefits, many barriers to getting routine dental care. And so that story has just kept on unwinding for me as a journalist.
That's a very powerful story. Your book seems to surround itself around the issues and disparities in oral health today, just by looking at the past and seeing how we got here. Can you tell us what exactly is the role of teeth in American history?
Well, as I was redoing my research for this book, I learned so many interesting stories about that. I mean, it's looking back, it's pretty amazing to think about it. But in the 17th century, a barber surgeon ministered to the dental needs of the Plymouth colony, you know, here in our very early American story. In the 18th century, goldsmith and ivory turner Paul Revere, you know, the patriot hero, constructed false teeth in Boston. And by the 19th century, the world's first dental college was established in Baltimore, not that many miles from where Diamante lived and died. And that first dental college in the world kind of served as a prototype for dental education throughout our country and actually in other countries too. It also kind of formed the foundation for the separate dental system we have today that provides care, and the separate financing system, the separate ways physicians and dentists look at our bodies and the way we ourselves think about our teeth and our oral health.
You know, it's interesting. When I think back to my own medical training, maybe Warren, yours the same, but, you know, the mouth was seemed to be a carve-out. We certainly were trained to look for cancers of the mouth, but we knew it was not really our domain. It was a dental domain. And I also know that since the beginning of my practice some 20 years ago, the difficulty of getting patients in to see dentists has, particularly for the, I mean, if you have insurance, it's fine, but if you're underinsured or not insured or have Medicaid, sometimes Medicare, it's really difficult. Where are we at today, and have things changed in the last 20 years?
Well, we still have this dualistic system. You mentioned Medicare. You know, that program provides, you know, health care services for over 55 million retired and disabled Americans. It has never, since it was signed into law in 1965, included coverage for routine dental benefits. So, you know, there are millions of seniors who are dentally uninsured, and Medicaid, fewer than half of dentists participate in the program. So, you know, even though, you know, more than 70 million Americans rely on Medicaid for their health care coverage, and children are entitled to care, you know, fewer than half of kids get it. And Medicaid dental benefits vary from state to state for adults. So adults can't always count on Medicaid covering their dental benefits. So you're talking about many millions of Americans who really don't have dental coverage or a dental home. And as a physician, you would face great difficulty, you know, finding a provider to refer them to. Of course, there's shortages in many places as well. You know, most of dental care is provided out of a private practice system in this country, and dentists aren't equally evenly divided across the country. They tend to gravitate to more affluent, you know, metropolitan areas to set up their practices. They're health care providers, but they also consider themselves in most cases small businessmen and women. So they set up their practices in places that, you know, guarantee or they hope will provide a good return on their investment and their education and their overhead. So there are places where there aren't any dentists for you to refer a patient to.
Well, Mary, as you're talking, as a physician, I'm seeing so many parallels between dentistry and medicine. A lot of it, you know, is around socioeconomic disparities, gender biases, racial inequalities, too. You know, as you were writing your book, are there any stories surrounding those areas that you found while you were researching?
Well, there are shortages of care. I mean, Diamante was an African-American child, and certainly since that was my first introduction to the shortage of care in a real experiential way, you know, as a reporter, I came to understand that there are grave racial disparities in care. It doesn't fully explain, you know, the problem, because tooth decay is so widely distributed. It's called the most prevalent chronic disease of American children and adults. You know, it's far more common than asthma and many of the other chronic illnesses we cope with as a society. But, you know, whereas, you know, one-third of white toddlers and primary school age children have decayed teeth, the disease afflicts closer to half of Black and Hispanic children. And, you know, by the time we're adults, tooth decay is almost universal. But then again, access to treatment is not universal. You know, like a quarter of whites have untreated decay, but more than a third of Hispanics and more than 40% of Black working age adults have untreated decay. It takes a toll on us throughout our lives, too. You know, I mean, you think about living with dental pain, and I met so many people who live with dental pain like it's a fact of their lives. I don't know how they endure it. I met people who'd pulled out their own teeth.
Oh, wow.
You know, people who'd waited in lines overnight for free care at these kind of charity clinics that set up in fairgrounds and other places, and you know, they waited to get a number and slept in their cars and waited for a dentist to see them. And most of them had been suffering for so long, the only option was really extraction of, you know, those diseased teeth. And some of these free clinics, you know, hundreds and even thousands of teeth are extracted. And those are teeth that are not going to grow back. You know, the people are going to have to live with that.
It sounds like there's
the consequences of that for the rest of their lives, you know?
Yeah, there's a certain sadness that resonates here, and one of which I know that you had to struggle with your book, and we want to actually talk with you a little bit about the experience of writing the book and since writing the book, but we need to take a short break. When we return, we're going to continue talking with health journalist and author Mary Otto about her recent book, Teeth, The Story of Beauty, Inequality, and the Struggle for Oral Health in America. We'll be right back with Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Warren Perry. Stay with us.
Your Health is supported by UNC Health Sciences Library and NC Health Info, working together to connect people everywhere with knowledge to improve health. Visit nchealthinfo.org for answers you can trust.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back. You've been listening to Your Health, and we've been talking with health journalist and author Mary Otto about her recent book called Teeth. And Mary, you know, I realize that in many respects, I probably should have been a dentist. I was the black sheep of a family. My entire family were dentists and orthodontists. I grew up with this understanding that dentists gave back to society. They got involved. They got engaged. My dad integrated his practice, the first in the state of Georgia. And I just, it's sad to me to understand that something that can make people smile and be so happy is the source of sometimes and oftentimes so much pain. And I can see patients in the emergency room or in my clinic, and the options for them seem so limited. Was this surprising for you when you wrote this book, and was it your hope that this might change things?
Well, I sure hope that, you know, the fact that we're talking about this today gives me some hope, you know, that we can raise the awareness. I think there's a lot of shame and judgment involved with oral health. You know, in some ways, we look at oral health and disease differently than other diseases. It's completely unfair, but the victims of oral disease are stigmatized in ways that, you know, the victims of, say, diabetes really aren't. And the fact is, so many millions of Americans just don't have access to routine care or even, you know, a history of comfort or ease with basic oral health messages because they haven't ever received them. And you mentioned emergency rooms. By the time people are in pain, you know, which is when people who don't have routine access tend to end up finally looking for help. You know, it is often too late to do much more than extract the tooth. You know, if you're lack dental benefits or the money to pay for out of pocket for a root canal or something like that. I was surprised that over 1 million Americans a year show up in emergency rooms with atraumatic dental problems like toothaches. And these visits cost the system over $1 billion a year, and they seldom result in, you know, the kind of dental care that people need. People usually get sent away with a prescription for a painkiller and an antibiotic, and they're told to go see their dentist. But many of these folks don't have a dentist. And I learned the tragic story of a young man named Kyle Willis, who was a young Ohio father and a fast food worker. He went to a community hospital in his community with an infected wisdom tooth, and like so many patients, he was given prescriptions for a pain medicine and an antibiotic, but he only had enough money to fill one of them, so he was in terrible pain, so he chose the painkiller. But the infection, of course, just got worse. A week later, his aunt told me he was rushed. She didn't know at the time he was struggling with this. He was rushed to the hospital, and this time in an ambulance, and the infection, like with Diamante's case, had escalated into a systemic crisis. He had a hemorrhage in the lining of his brain. He went into convulsions, and as he was being transported to a big hospital in Cincinnati, he went into a coma, and he died later that day. And the cause of the death was a cerebral edema due to a dental abscess. And, you know, thankfully, deaths from dental abscesses are rarer than they were like in the days before antibiotics. Yet, you know, people like Kyle Willis and Diamante Driver still suffer terribly and even die from these infections, just like, you know, they did back in the colonial times.
Wow.
You never forget those stories.
Yeah, and that's a very, very touching story. And you actually touched on something that I was going to ask you, and I hope you could elaborate on. As an emergency medicine physician, one of my most difficult complaints is dental pain, because most of them, you're right, aren't emergency, but they're frustrating. You know, having a mouth that's in pain, you can't mm-hmm. eat, you can't sleep. Right. It's very nagging. Is there mm-hmm. any advice you have for either people who are having pain such as this, or more particularly emergency medicine physicians, like what they can do for patients like this?
That's really interesting. Some places, in response to, you know, this overwhelming, you know, numbers of people who are showing up, in my travels, I've met with folks who have set up emergency room diversion programs where there's maybe a dentist on call, and there's some kind of a funding mechanism or referral mechanism. So, you know, you can either call a dentist to see the patient or give the patient someone who's ready to see them. In other places, there are other creative approaches to addressing this problem, but it's kind of a patchwork, you know, of attempts. But there are places where things are being done to address this problem, because it is not only so painful and even dangerous for patients, but it's costly to the system.
You know, we're talking with Mary Otto, the author of a new book, Teeth, Story of Beauty, Inequality, and the Struggle for Oral Health in America. And Mary, you've touched on the inequalities. I think the struggle is one that we respect and admire, and maybe you'll end up in a minute or two telling us about your kind of view for some solutions. Speak to us for a moment of where the word beauty, and how did that come into the title of the book, and how does that play out in terms of your concerns about dental health care?
Well, I came into this subject through kind of the public health door, but the cosmetic and elective dental industry is a large part of our oral health care system in this country, and it's a very remunerative one for providers. In fact, you know, it's a sad irony that in this country, where roughly a third of Americans lack routine access to care, it's also created the Hollywood smile, or the American smile, that's a status symbol around the world. I learned the interesting story of the creation of cosmetic dentistry, which also happened here in this country, and it actually grew out of the Depression-era Hollywood. In those days, the movies were kind of a new phenomenon. People flocked to them, though, in the Depression because they wanted just a little bit of escape and pleasure in those dark days. And this dentist named Charles Pincus went to the movies, too. He looked up onto the silver screen and saw that those early movie stars didn't have what we would consider Hollywood smiles today. And he created these little snap-on veneers. They became known as Hollywood veneers. So stars like Shirley Temple would have appeared to have perfect teeth. You know, even though, say, Shirley Temple, she was a little six-year-old when she became a big star. Of course, she lost her baby teeth, but we never saw that. She wore these Hollywood veneers throughout her childhood. So we assume she has had this perfect little strand of pearly teeth. And many of the adult stars also went to Dr. Pincus for their cosmetic dental treatments. The whole ideas of veneers and bonding and all the state-of-the-art kind of cosmetic services that people pay out of pocket for today came along in the 1980s, and medical credit cards really came into their own in the 1990s, so people had ways to pay for these treatments that, you know, are elective and not medically necessary, but are in high demand. You know, so now young women who are getting married and want to have beautiful teeth for their wedding albums go in and have cosmetic procedures. They're kind of a status symbol and a rite of passage for many Americans.
Yeah, I've definitely seen the Hollywood smile. Can you tell us a little bit how we can improve and, you know, what are the things that we as society should do to move forward?
There's a lot of talk now about ways to bridge that gap between our healthcare system and our dental care system. And there is that divide between providers that I know you both mentioned, and the fact that our dental records are separate from our medical records, and our physicians and dentists don't always talk to each other or know each other. There's sort of a trend toward more patient-centered care that health leaders are trying to bring to this arena to resolve this kind of dualistic way we think about oral health. There's also some work on the workforce issue to bring dental providers into the community more. So patients don't always have to go seek dental care in the private practice system, but get dental hygienists and other kinds of dental workers into schools and nursing homes and senior centers and even like WIC centers where people go to pick up their food supplements and things like that to bring oral health education and kind of a link to the oral health system to patients who might not otherwise find their way into it by themselves. So these are very interesting and hopeful and sometimes controversial things that are being discussed right now. There's also an interest in providing, you know, our dental system still rewards surgical procedures, fillings and extractions and elective procedures. But there's interest among some public health leaders in rewarding more of the preventive care that people need to keep their oral health throughout their lifetimes and find ways to incentivize providers and patients to think about prevention. Also, simple things like community water fluoridation. Again, a big public health effort that hasn't reached everyone in this country.
Yeah, you know, I'm thinking that the issues that you raise are the ones that are the questions, and the start of maybe getting answers is simply asking really good questions. And I think we were really appreciative, perhaps your health listeners, of you asking good questions and stimulating a conversation that we hope furthers along this mission that we all have of improving oral health. So we really appreciate Mary Otto being our guest today.
Thank you, Adam and Warren, both of you, for keeping the conversation going. I'm really grateful to be with you.
We've been talking with health journalist and author Mary Otto about her recent book, Teeth, The Story of Beauty, Inequality, and the Struggle for Oral Health in America. And we'll make a copy of this on our website for our listeners so they can go and see about purchasing it. We're going to take a short break, but coming up on House Calls, we'll be answering questions about your health. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Warren Perry. We'll be right back.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. And now, back to the show.
Welcome back to Your Health. For the House Call segment of our show today, we're going to spend a few minutes talking about listener health questions and concerns. And more, and if a listener has a question they'd like us to address on an upcoming show, they can send their comments to yourhealth@unc.edu. That's yourhealth@unc.edu. And we'd like to ask our great executive producer, Laura Lacey, to read us our very first House Call question about a teenager who's actually been to the emergency room a couple times. Laura?
My 19-year-old daughter has been to the ER twice in the past 18 months because she felt like she couldn't breathe. Each time, the attending doctor told us she was suffering from a severe panic attack. Of course, I want to get her to a physician as quickly as possible if and when she needs one, but are there some things we should be doing at home when she feels like this? At what point do we take her to the ER?
Warren, I'm sure you see people coming into the emergency room with shortness of breath, and to make that link between a 19-year-old in this case and panic attack, people don't come in and say, I'm having a panic attack. The doctor figured that out. How would you figure that out?
Well, first, as an emergency medicine physician, I always think about emergencies. So once I've ruled out emergencies, then I look to see exactly what might be going on. So it's basically just off the presentation. It's off their vital signs. In particular to this patient right here with the panic attacks, if the doctor has ruled out emergency, which it sounds like they probably have because she's gone home and been okay and has come back, you know, you want to look at what are your triggers possibly. Is there something in particular that caused you to have the panic attacks? And then what helps you resolve them? Breathing exercise? Is just some conservative measures that can help you until you're able to go see a psychiatrist or your primary care doctor who can give you some definitive management.
You know, it makes me think that somewhere someone gave a history about maybe being anxious and something triggering. I sometimes get worried because we know that panic attacks at that age could be precipitated for lots of reasons, but there could also be some trauma that occurs. So I sometimes want to know, did this woman, was she the subject of some sort of abuse? And if we don't ask about it, we'll never know. Did something happen on a college campus? And, you know, bullying, all kinds of things, social media kinds of issues here. There are things going on in the family of stress. But regardless, this is serious. It's made this person feel like they couldn't breathe, and so they showed in the emergency room. So I think you're absolutely right. Treatment is really indicated in their behavioral treatments, and I think this meditation and biofeedback and deep breathing would be some great things there. Pharmacologically, medications may well be part of what's needed too, and the short-term things to help someone calm down and give them some control back in their life, and some longer-term things to help maybe reverse what could biologically be happening. I think both of those could be indicated.
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah. Well, thank you for that question. We hope that you get in to see someone soon. And certainly talk with your doctor or their doctor, campus health, about resources. There are lots of things that the campus health can do if they're on a campus. Laura, what's our very next house call?
I'm a 33-year-old man, and I've been having what seems like muscle pain in my abdomen for months that isn't going away. I've been seeing a physical therapist who thinks I have strained my adductor. What is that muscle, and why is it so hard to heal?
Well, first off, I can relate to things that are uncomfortable. That's sometimes that are in like places it's really hard to figure out. I mean, you know, people get pain in their groin, pain in their abdomen, pain in their back. People present to the emergency room. I'm sure you see this a lot, Ward. And you can't always really see, and you don't want to sit there and do a CAT scan on everyone you see, and the X-ray, radiation, that kind of things cost. So trying to figure out what it is, sometimes I do refer to physical therapists to help me figure out what's going on. In this case, they think it's the adductor muscle.
Yeah, the adductor muscle is one of those muscles that you really don't think about until you strain it. Basically, what it does is it helps you pull your legs into each other, if you can think about it that way. And it can be kind of difficult to heal. Your legs, you're constantly losing, you're using your legs. You're constantly using these muscles to walk, to maintain your posture. So it can be difficult to tease out which muscle is hurting, and then also even more difficult to treat it.
You know, and this is one of those cases that if it's not getting better and you're doing what the physical therapist recommended, this is when you well may need additional studies or an X-ray, because you might have a hernia, you might have a strain of other muscles, you might be having less frequently, but something going on with your gastrointestinal system. Mm-hmm. Common things happen commonly. An adductor muscle strain can happen, but you might have something that's uncommon here. And I think if it's not getting better, I would definitely go see someone.
I agree.
Yeah. Laura, what's our very next house call?
My neighbor's son just had to go to the emergency room to get his appendix removed. It was quite a scary ordeal, actually, and has our whole block a little shaken. My son is around the same age and is prone to stomach aches. How do you know when something is a simple stomach ache versus appendicitis?
Well, how long do we have here to talk about this?
That is the golden question.
Yeah, this is a great question. And first off, we do hope your neighbor's son is doing well. I think that, you know, you're doing okay one day and the next day you have this sudden abdominal pain and then like 2 hours later you're getting surgery. And actually that would be a good outcome if you have this appendicitis that needs mm-hmm. surgery, because you don't want it to rupture, mm-hmm. which could be really sick. So we're really glad that that's occurred.
Yeah. And, you know, if I could tell you how to determine appendicitis from just normal stomach pain, I'd be a rich man right now and would not be sitting here. But I think you bring up a good question. I think your overall question is, when is stomach pain an emergency? I think that's really what you're trying to ask. And the way to figure that out is very difficult. The key things that as a physician I look for are we call toxic appearing features in a patient. Fever, nausea, vomiting, diarrhea, just unable to get comfortable, or just things that just make you look at a person and say, you look really sick. But then at the end of the day, I tell patients, you know, if you feel uncomfortable about anything going on with yourself, come to the emergency department. We're here 24/7 to help you.
Yeah. And I might even say, even before you go to the emergency room, go to your primary care physician or your pediatrician, because most times, the great majority of times, abdominal pain is not appendicitis. It's not surgical. And it certainly can be managed in an outpatient setting safely and effectively, and help determine whether or not we do need to take that next step. Because if you show up in the emergency room and you've got abdominal pain, more times than not, you're going to have an additional workup done. And it mm-hmm. is going to be expensive and it may involve more things, but it is the fallback place that people do need to go, particularly if they can't get in access somewhere else. I think in general, if you're concerned, we're kind of concerned. If it stays there longer than 24 hours, we're concerned. Mm-hmm. You should definitely go in and see someone. Most of the viruses will go away within, you know, 2 or 3 days. The pain's getting worse in that right lower quadrant, and that's if you draw kind of a bullseye right at the belly button. It's that one, if you're facing the bullseye on the left lower portion, but if it's you, it's that right lower portion of your belly. That's where you kind of worry about appendicitis. Mm-hmm. I don't know why they call it McBurney's Point.
Because I believe, and don't quote me on this, I believe the surgeon or the doctor who found that point, his name is McBurney. And it's just basically that midpoint in between your pelvic bone and your belly button.
You think he got rich with that?
I don't know.
Well, we're going to ask our great health sciences librarians to put a picture up of that point in that diagram so our listeners can see it. Laura, what's our very last house call?
I'm in my late 20s and just got strep throat for the first time since I was a kid. It was horrible. I haven't felt that awful in some time, and I certainly don't remember strep throat being so terrible when I was younger. Is it harder to combat as an adult? Am I likely to get it again as an adult now that it's happened once?
Well, first off, we're sorry you got strep. And I know we think of strep as just an easy disease and diagnosis. You do the test, you take some antibiotics, you get better. And that is what happens most of the time. But the organism that causes strep, different types of strep can cause some pretty serious diseases. You probably, unfortunately, see some of those more serious diseases more frequently than I do in a primary care physician.
Yeah. In the emergency department, we see strep that's pretty far gone. We see strep that's become more invasive into the tonsils. We see tonsils that have abscesses in them. We see people who have what we call systemic symptoms from it, meaning that their whole body's infected from it because they just become so toxic. So it's definitely something that you want to address pretty early on.
Yeah, I would say, what can you do to prevent it? Well, certainly if you smoke, don't smoke. Certainly if you're getting there more often, you do need to probably go in and see why that may be occurring. It's unusual to get it frequently if you didn't have it frequently as a child. But in this case, hope you don't have it anymore.
Yeah.
Well, that'll conclude the Research That Matters portion of our show. And we hope that we've addressed issues and concerns that are important to you on your health today. You can send any questions you have by emailing us at yourhealth@unc.edu. You can visit us online at yourhealthradio.org or follow us on Twitter, Facebook, or iTunes. We'd like to thank the UNC Department of Family Medicine, UNC Healthcare for their sponsorship, my great co-host, Dr. Warren Perry, and our guest today, Mary Otto. We hope you'll join us next time on Your Health. On behalf of Your Health, I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
I'm Dr. Warren Perry.
And we look forward to talking to you again next week. Take care.
The purpose of Your Health Radio is to educate listeners on healthcare issues. Listeners should always discuss their own health or medical concerns with their personal physician or other healthcare provider. Your health is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.
You've been listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine.